Today, deposit insurance where the insurer has no money to pay. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I'm joined again by economist John Adams. Hello John, good to see you again.
Hello sir.
Now you've been beavering away at the financial claims scheme. And in fact, you've written an article, which is out there.
Yes.
And you've gone into a significant amount of detail. And I think it's really important that people understand what this claims scheme is, how it works, and what the risks are.
Yes. Part of my other role as being a chief economist for a gold and silver dealership, I wrote a column for them, As Good as Gold Australia. And I go to some extent into the financial claims scheme. And I think this discussion complements nicely our previous discussion about bail-in, because I'm getting a lot of correspondence, and I'm sure you're getting the same, that now that we've explored bail-in, people think, okay, I'm a little bit nervous about my money being in the bank, but particularly if it's above $250,000, which is what the claim scheme says it will support. But there's still a sense of some confidence that the deposit will be safe because of this scheme. Now, I wrote a column earlier in the year for news.com about the 10 myths about the coming economic Armageddon. And I wrote that that this belief in the financial claim scheme that the government will insure your deposit, it is a bit of a myth. And there's some very specific detail that most Australians are not aware of about the scheme that I think that is worthwhile to explore.
Okay. Well, let's do just that. And I guess it's worth saying in context, you know, there was a lot of reaction post the GFC, right?
So the insurance, the financial claim scheme was announced by Kevin Rudd on the weekend of the 11th and 12th of October 2008. And the history goes that, now obviously Rudd was well aware that something could be blowing up given subprime happened in 2007. And so some work had already been done about some sort of deposit insurance scheme. But on this weekend of the 11th and 12th, there was this rumor going around that a run on the banks was going to happen on the Monday, on the 13th of October 2008. And therefore, they announced that deposits were going to be insured, and they obviously put the detail on the table. And the purpose of the announcement was to give confidence to people that they should be keeping their money in the bank, not to have a bank run on the Monday, because if there was a bank run, then there would be a massive issue with liquidity among the banks, particularly the Big Four. And the Big Four were already facing liquidity issues given what was happening in the international credit market. And a bank run, kind of like what happened with Mary Poppins when Michael and Jane were in the bank. Had that happened on the 13th of October 2008, that would have exacerbated the liquidity issues, and it could have, you know, led to one of the banks potentially falling over. So this was, in effect, a mechanism to restore confidence, to say don't pull your money out of the bank. And the government was successful in that because people were reassured that if they kept their money in the system, that the system would protect their money.
And it's worth saying that other players around the world, for example, in the UK and in Ireland, had previously implemented the same sort of scheme, right?
Yeah.
In fact, we were late to the party.
Yes.
Relative to some of the other players.
Yes.
And in fact, I was in the UK at the time that things really went bad, right? And I heard the announcements in the UK, came back to Australia, and there were no such insurance plays in place. And then a couple of weeks later, they appeared.
Sure. So before we go into the financial claims scheme, so can I just ask you, when it comes to Northern Rock, now there was a run on Northern Rock in the UK, even though the BBC was saying everything was fine. And I think from memory, the assurances given on the BBC actually made everyone saying, oh no, like the fact that BBC is saying it means that there's actually an issue. So it actually was counterintuitive, and then that actually precipitated the run. So I guess the question is, was there deposit insurance in the UK before Northern Rock?
No, there wasn't really. So the way it worked was that there was an initial run on Northern Rock at the point when the government said that they would actually guarantee Northern Rock.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
And so that announcement, rather than it being seen as something really positive, right, basically created the problem in the first place.
Uh-huh.
Right. And in fact, there's a wonderful clip still available on YouTube where the BBC guy is saying, don't see there's any issue, you know. He was actually their chief finance correspondent at the time, right? And in fact, that very quote then triggered more people the following day to form queues outside Northern Rock to try and move their money.
So before we get into the detail, so why was it that when Australia said your deposit is safe, Australians bought it, whereas when it was said in the UK, people didn't buy it?
No. The difference was that the first thing the UK government did was to guarantee money to Northern Rock.
Right.
Not guarantee deposits.
I see.
So it was basically a liquidity injection.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Okay, yeah.
36 hours now, they've been told their money is absolutely safe.
The Bank of England would not have lent us any money if we were in an unstable financial position. It's as simple as that. They would not.
But at branches right across the country, Northern Rock customers have been queuing for hours to take their money out. Everyone from the Bank of England to the Chancellor has been telling them that there's no threat to their savings. But that doesn't appear to have made any impression.
The Chancellor has said, don't panic.
So did the captain of the Titanic. That went down.
I'm not panicking, I'm being totally rational. I'm just moving my money somewhere else.
This is also a crisis for internet banking. Miranda Hall has been trying and failing to get access to her Northern Rock online account since Thursday evening. The bank says its website is now working a bit better, but this customer is having second thoughts about banking online.
I have no means, absolutely no means, at this moment in time of accessing my money. And that, for me, is an uncomfortable place to be. Very uncomfortable, actually.
So what exactly is happening to Northern Rock's deposits? There's £5.6 billion in branch accounts, about £4 billion on the internet, and nearly £10 billion in postal accounts. By last night, around £250 million had been withdrawn from branches, with £750 million gone from online accounts. More withdrawals will be arriving in the post, and, of course, a lot more money has gone out today. But even in the unlikely event that everyone withdrew their cash, the Bank of England's money should be enough to keep Northern Rock afloat. And tonight, the Chancellor weighed in with more assurance.
I appreciate there have been difficulties with the queues and with the internet, simply because they're not used to dealing with this volume of business in the normal run of events. But the point is, if people want to get their money out, it's there because it is backed by the Bank of England. I authorise the Bank of England to provide that support because I think it's important that we should maintain the stability of our banking system.
So that was not misinterpreted, but that was read by people as saying, the government may say it's safe, but we're not sure.
I see.
Right.
I see.
So then subsequently, Ireland and the UK both then announced unlimited deposit insurance, because they were concerned of the contagion that could spread beyond Northern Rock and elsewhere. And of course, at that time, other banks around the world were falling like flies and everybody was really nervous about the financial system.
Sure.
So effectively, then became a need to insure deposits.
Yeah.
Right.
Excellent. Okay, so why don't we go into the key features? So when this was announced in October of 2008, there were some key features that was announced by the Rudd government about the scheme.
Yeah, there's a long list if you go to the site of which accounts are included, and it's pretty clear that it's really personal accounts, it's personal superannuation accounts, those things are included.
And when it comes to mortgage offset accounts, that's also included?
Yes, it seems to be, although it's a little bit vague, I think, as to precisely how it would work. But there's quite a long list.
So initially, the deposits were insured up to $1 million per customer per institution. Each institution was entitled to $20 billion worth of deposit insurance, plus $100 million in administration costs. The scheme had to be activated, and I think this is a key point, because most people don't realise this, is that the insurance at the moment, but also when it was constituted in 2008, means that as of today, the insurance is not live. So for example, when someone goes to buy an insurance policy, well, you've paid your premium, therefore the insurance is live. And if a risk event occurs, you know, because you have an insurance contract and you've paid your premium, you can go claim that insurance. Well, in this case, the insurance is not live, and it actually has to be legally activated by the government for the insurance to kick in. So that was a part of the system then. It is a part of the system today. And obviously, if you go to the APRA website about the financial claim scheme, it is there in crystal clear language that the scheme must be activated. So any politician saying that your deposit insurance or your deposits are insured at the moment, technically, there's an implicit political promise that that will happen, but legally, it is not insured until the insurance is turned on. So think of you're in a car and you've got to sort of flick the switch. So there was that. And then the other key feature was there was what they call an ex post funding model. And basically what that means is that the government said that when a risk event were to occur and they had to pay the deposit insurance, they would just come up with the money then and then. And then they would try to recoup the insurance paid out via a bank levy. So obviously, you know, it would take time for a bank levy to, just say they paid $20 billion out to an institution. So they would impose a industry-wide bank levy that ultimately would be paid by customers and shareholders. And they would take, you know, several years to recoup that money. So that was a feature in terms of the system 2008. It's still the same funding model. And obviously, when we look at the title of the show about the deposit insurance when the insurer has no money to pay. So the reason why we've used that title is because of this particular funding model that the government has not set aside a single dollar to pay the insurance. And there's an implicit assumption that if the insurance is required to be paid, they will come up in terms of the money. Now, when I was writing about this early in the year and I was calling a few friends of mine and said, if you have an insurance contract, but the insurer says to you, we actually don't have the money here and now to pay the insurance, what do you think that's actual legitimate insurance? And a lot of people said to me, well, of course not. If I've got an insurance contract and the insurance company can't guarantee that they have sufficient funds to pay the insurance if I claim the insurance, well, that's not legitimate insurance. And yet this is precisely what we have in Australia. And the government says this is insurance. But for me, this is not insurance because the government has no money set aside in a pool of funds that it can draw upon to pay the insurance when and if required. So there's a bit of a backstory about this funding model, and there was some criticism in 2012 by the IMF about the Australian approach, and we'll get into that shortly.
And I guess it's worth saying that, you know, this sort of scheme probably worked in an isolated failure scenario, right?
Yes.
Particularly if it's a small bank, right? But the question is, how robust would it be in the situation where you had potentially multiple failures and multiple banks, right? And I think that's something people need to think about, and perhaps we'll explore that a bit later as we go forward too. Right?
Yes, yes. So to take the story on, so when the insurance was announced in 2008, $1 million per customer per institution. Then in 2011, I think there was some international analysis done on Australia, but also the Council of Financial Regulators basically said that given that the insurance per institution was $20 billion for the insurance and $100 million administration costs, that was insufficient insurance coverage to cover in deposits up to $1 million. So they basically were public in their concerns that the banks were being underinsured, and they basically called on the government to reduce the level of insurance. So this is where in February 2012, Wayne Swan announced that they would be reducing the level of insurance per customer per institution, and they went from $1 million per customer per institution down to $250,000, and that is basically where we sit today. So 2008 to 2012, it was $1 million. Now it's $250,000, and that's where we are today.
Yep. And just to be clear, that's per institution.
Yes.
And that's per customer per institution, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So in other words, you could have $250,000 in Bank 1, Bank 2, Bank 3 and Bank 4, and provided they were separate legal entities, all Australian banks,
yeah,
you'd be protected. But if you actually had money in three of those banks and they were all subsidiaries of the same group, so you know, if you were at Westpac and St George and South Australia Bank, that wouldn't count, because effectively that would be only up to 250 in the group.
Yes, yes. So the other important aspect to say is if you have multiple accounts with the one bank, so if you've got a personal account and an offset account, so what we're saying is that if you have, just say someone has $400,000 in the bank across several accounts, well, your insurance is at the 250 mark for all of those accounts. So it's per customer, per institution.
Yep, exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. So basically where to from here is that there was a IMF Financial Stability Review Assessment in 2012 looking at the financial system for Australia and New Zealand. And the IMF had some very specific things to say about the financial claim scheme. So our funding model, which is this ex post model that the government is assumed to have to come up the money when it is required and then to make up the money through a bank levy afterwards, this is the IMF was concerned about. They said that this is not consistent with international best practice and that the IMF recommended what they call a ex ante funding model, which is to say impose a bank levy now, start to create a pool of funds over time, and then if the insurance is ever triggered, you actually have money there and then in which you can then draw upon to pay the insurance. So this is the equivalent of if we have house insurance or car insurance, well, we pay a premium and that premium comes together to be that pool of funds that if claims are to be paid, well, that insurance, that premium pool, that is there to then pay the insurance. So that's effectively what the IMF said should happen. They said that's a bit international best practice. And when Kevin Rudd came back to be Prime Minister in 2013, his treasurer at the time was Chris Bowen. And Chris Bowen and Penny Wong, who was the finance minister, made an announcement in September 2013 to impose a bank levy consistent with the IMF recommendation to go to this ex-ante funding model. And the levy was supposed to raise about $733 million, I think, per annum on the banks. So obviously the banks were not happy about wanting to pay this, but they made this announcement just before the 2013 election. Then Tony Abbott's government came into power in 2013, and they basically said in the MIEFO statement in December of 2013 that they would keep consistent with the Labor recommendation until the Financial Services Inquiry takes a closer look. So this, obviously, the inquiry basically was run by David Murray, the former CEO of the Commonwealth Bank. So basically, you could say a bank insider was running the inquiry. And no surprise that when the Financial Services Inquiry report came out, the inquiry rejected the IMF recommendation for this ex-ante funding model. And they basically said, let's keep with the original funding model, which is ex post, which is this implicit assumption that the government will be able to just come up with the funds on the spot, and then you impose a bank levy afterwards. Because obviously the banks didn't want to pay the in terms of the levy up front. So that was the recommendation that came from the Financial Services Inquiry, and the Abbott government accepted that recommendation, therefore implicitly rejecting the IMF recommendation. And that funding model is still intact to today. So as we speak today, the government has not put a single cent aside to pay the insurance if the insurance is required to be paid. And there is an assumption that if the insurance is required, the government somehow, somewhere, will just come up with the funds to pay out the insurance.
And it's worth saying that more recently, the government did introduce a levy on the big five banks, right? But that was nothing to do with this particular scheme, right? That was to do with effectively just general funding, and that goes into the general treasury pot.
Yes.
So that's nothing to do with putting specific provisions aside for deposit schemes.
Exactly, yep. Exactly.
So, John, I want to go further on these key limitations, right? Because I think that if you ask most people, they would assume, one, the guarantee is in place.
Yes.
Two, anybody with 250K is protected.
That's right.
Right? They won't know about the limits and things.
Yes.
And three, it's there now.
Yes.
Now, what you've said is that actually all of those three are yes buts.
Yes.
Okay. So let's go into more detail about what those limitations actually are and what it means.
Yes, yes. So where I think the bigger concern about the limitation of the scheme is what you just said earlier in the conversation, which is that when they... So this was a policy to give people confidence. And people have confidence because they have accepted the face value statements of the government and they haven't sort of dug into the detail. Now, if we go into some of our previous conversations about Armageddon coming, the international credit markets dry up, just assume two or three banks get into trouble and that they need to be, that they need, the insurance kicks in because they have failed. Well, what happens in that situation is that the government has to come up with about, just say, 40 or 60 billion if it's two or three institutions to come up with the deposit insurance. If you have a financial crisis, just like with 2008, tax revenues collapse because the economy is in free fall, which means that the deficit blows out. So that means that the government has to borrow money to fund the deficit. On top of, you've got to fund the existing amount of debt that the government has. And as we speak of today, gross government debt, federal government debt, is north of $900 billion in terms of gross liabilities. So for me, I've always said that in that situation where it's hard for anyone to get money in the international credit markets, people don't have spare funds to lend. And if the government has to fund, because, the deficit last financial year came in at about $10 billion. Back of the envelope calculation, if we had a full-on crisis, the deficit could easily blow out to 50 billion, 60 billion. One member of parliament told me a few months ago that they wouldn't be surprised that in a global financial crisis, a new one, if the deficit blew out to $80 billion. So just say they had to fund $80 billion. Now, that happens when tax revenue falls. If there is to say, well, we will actually come up with a new stimulus package that could actually add to the deficit. So tax revenue falls, deficit of 60 billion. New stimulus package, another 10, 20 billion, could be $80, $100 billion deficit. Plus, if you're going to come up with 40 or 60 billion to pay deposit insurance, well, where do you get that money? And I think that in that situation of, a dire financial situation, two or three institutions have failed, I am very skeptical that the government will be able to borrow the money in that situation. So I think that's a big limitation that the policymakers hasn't thought through. What happens not if one institution fails, but if multiple? And what happens if this happens in a financial crisis where the deficits, the tax revenue is in free fall, the deficit's blown out, and the international credit markets have dried up, and it's actually hard to borrow?
Yep. So it's like read the small print, right? Because it's not necessarily as advertised.
Well, yes, so it's read the small print, but when we've talked about it in the previous episode about scenario thinking, so again, I don't think RBA, Treasury or APRA have really thought through, well, so I think they're thinking, well, if one falls and economic conditions are okay with this insurance, the government will be able to meet its obligations, even if it doesn't have money aside. But what happens in a nightmare scenario where two, three banks, credit markets have dried up, and they'd really have to come up with an extra, well, just say three banks, 60 billion plus maybe 100 to 80 to 100 billion for the deficit plus funding existing liabilities. You're talking north of maybe $200 billion that they have to come up with to meet all of these things. And the question is, well, where does that come up? But what I think they will do is ultimately they will sacrifice the dollar.
Okay, John, so we've talked about the scheme itself, but now we should consider the risks attached to it.
So yes, I think there's a few risks. The first risk for me is whether or not the financial scheme becomes activated. Mm. So think about bail-in first. So I think in this context, I think it's fair to say that a prime minister or a treasurer would say, well, how do we save the banks to stop a depression? But how do we do it that has the least financial cost to the government? Well, the easiest way is to bail in, so that you can minimize the cost to the taxpayer. So, and obviously in previous conversations, this is the whole premise of bail-in, to reduce the call on the taxpayer. So I think they would try to do that first. They may then try to nationalize, if they must nationalize the banks. But then even if because the financial claims scheme is the last option. So once everything has failed to work, if an institution does fail, well then they have to come up in terms of the 20 billion. So now, once you've gone through those various steps of bail-in, nationalization, and then you get to, do you actually, and the institution has failed, do you pay the insurance? Do you not pay the insurance? Well, there's a political judgment that has to be made there. Can the government come up with the money? What are the implications if they pay, they don't pay? All of that sort of stuff. So I think that's risk number one. In that crisis situation, does the government turn it on or keep it off? And I don't think we can automatically assume that they will. I think that the political practicality that they will, but there is a risk that in that crisis situation, they will not activate the scheme. So I think that's risk number one. The second risk is when it comes to underinsurance. So the level of, this is according to the budget papers, in February 2012, $623 billion of deposits was covered under the scheme. As of December of 2017, that number grew to $890 billion. The level of deposits that are covered under the scheme has grown by $260 billion, and yet the level of insurance per institution hasn't changed. And so the question for me is that particularly with the big four banks that hold about 78 to 80% of all the deposits, which is personal and commercial, if one of the big four falls and you add up all the claims for the deposit insurance, is that going to be up to $20 billion or is that going to be more? I think there's a big risk that they should look at increasing the level of insurance per institution, but they may have already looked at the modelling, but it's unsure to me as to whether, given that the deposits has grown $260 billion, whether the big four are insured appropriately or they're underinsured.
Well, the fact that the value has gone up, but the insurance cover hasn't gone up, tells you something, doesn't it?
Yeah. So that's risk number two about underinsurance. Risk number three is whether the government has sufficient borrowing capacity to meet the obligations. And obviously, this is where, in a full-blown financial crisis, when they've got multiple calls on funds from existing debt to the deficit to the financial claim scheme and other things, is there sufficient liquidity in the international credit markets for them to borrow to meet this stuff? Very hard to fully know what will play out in terms of that situation. Because we had a massive injection of liquidity in late 2008 to 2009. So will central banks do that again? They printed $15 trillion last time. They'll have to print more than $15 trillion. Do they have the capacity to do that? But also in terms of timing of that liquidity, do they do it in time for the government to borrow a sufficient amount of money at the critical juncture so that they can pay the insurance or not? They're things that are unclear. So obviously, risk four, that if they do pay and they can't borrow, they have to print. And if they print, the purchasing power of the dollars diminish. So you will get your $250,000 Australian dollars, that's been insured. But what does that actually buy you? There's a big risk that could buy you less. And so on that point, this is where I've had some discussions in Parliament with various people, and they've said that in the crisis, you've got to pick the least worst option. And the least worst option, which we've talked about previously, is the time frame, short-term versus medium-term. Well, the politicians and the advisors want to extinguish a short-term crisis. And they've said, if we have to sacrifice the dollar to overcome these short-term crisis conditions, we will worry about inflation and the value of the dollar later on. So if in this crisis situation they've got a print, the exchange rate could fall, the value of the dollar could fall, and obviously you get your 250, but what does it actually buy you? I think that's a big risk. And then obviously the fifth risk is that will they, because if the obligations are so extreme on the taxpayer, do they trigger bail-in to reduce the financial exposure of the government? Obviously, the government continues to say, and we got some fresh correspondence today, that bail-in is not on the table. We've gone through the details to say that, no, we think that bail-in potentially could be on the table. And it could well be that in order to reduce the financial liabilities of the government in this crisis situation, they could use bail-in so that they can reduce the overall bill to the taxpayer.
Well, the truth is that bail-in will be used before the bank falls over, right? That's the whole point. So you try not to allow the bank to fall over, in which case the deposit insurance scheme wouldn't need to be activated.
Yeah.
So you can almost see them making a trade-off.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that's the basic elements of the financial claim scheme. There are some risks. There are some limitations. I don't think policymakers, particularly in Parliament, have fully explored how this scheme will work in various scenarios. So I think it's fair to say to people, you've got your money in the bank. A lot of people have got the money in the bank on the presumption that there is a level of insurance. We're not saying that automatically the insurance will not be paid, but there's clearly conditions in which it may not be paid, or if it is paid, you will be paid in dollars that are worth less than what it is today. So there are some risks that are involved in the scheme. And obviously when people make their financial planning decisions, they've got to consider those risks and limitations in how they allocate their capital.
Sure. And it's interesting, if you look in the documentation from the deposit accounts, they all mention the fact they've got the financial claims scheme backing.
Yes.
So from a marketing perspective, right, the banks are using the fact that that backstop exists.
Yes.
And what we've shown is, well, it does exist, but there are a few question marks around it that people should be aware of.
Yes, yes. And I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong here, the banks aren't explicitly saying, hey, there is this promise, but it actually isn't turned on yet.
They never say it's not turned on yet. They just say that this particular account is subject to, you know, the financial claims scheme. So they tend to spin it positively, shall I say.
Typical bank behaviour.
John, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So there you have it. A little bit more information about the financial claims scheme. Don't panic. It does exist, but it does need to be activated, and there are some limitations. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching. If you enjoyed the post, please like it, share it, make a comment, and check back for the next one. See you later.